Hey friends, software is everywhere, putting us devs on the front lines of innovation, improving people's lives, shipping new and better features, all while moving faster than ever before, which is where our friends at Raygun can help. Their powerful error and performance monitoring tools make it easy to get all the diagnostics you care about for your team's web and mobile apps. When there's an issue, it shows you exactly what's going on, who's being impacted, and how to fix the root cause, down to the specific line of code. See how your users are experiencing your website or app in real time and ship better code faster with confidence, knowing that Raygun will alert you to any new issues or regressions. Start a free 14-day trial of Raygun today and try it for yourself. It only takes a few lines of code, and their simple usage-based plans start at $4 a month, a small price to pay to get your team and users to love you. Visit Raygun.com. Try it out. Thank me later. Hi, I'm Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm chatting with Huda Idris. She's the founder and CEO of Dot Health. It's a real-time personal health data platform. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm very interested in speaking to you because I have health problems, and you know, they don't bother me from day to day. But I realized before I got to talk to you that I've been putting together dashboards since I became diabetic. Like, my entire last 20 years have been dedicated to getting access to my health data. And that's what you're all about, giving people access to their health data.
Yeah, there are so many more people. Once I got into this, I realized how many people were actually going around and piecing it together on their own and sort of building this company around it. I don't come from healthcare. So it was an interesting, really learning experience for me, and has been for the last several years.
Why did you decide it was a problem? Like, everyone has an origin, like a villain origin story. Like, you're hanging out with your friends and you're like, someone should do something. And then Huda's like, I will start the company.
I mean, it was a little bit of an accident, I'll be honest. I wish I could have like this incredible story of like, I planned it and then it like came into fruition. But my best friend from university, his dad, unfortunately, was diagnosed with late stage liver cancer. And the beginning of Dot was really just helping him. And it was a really clunky, and I'm a product designer, so the first version of Dot was really embarrassing. It was just like this really ugly, clunky dashboard that showed him his cancer marker progress. So he was going through chemo, he was getting blood work done, and they were basically checking what his cancer marker levels were. And he was going to 5 different healthcare providers, and this is in Canada. So, you know, they all sort of live in different parts of the health ecosystem, and he's going and visiting all of them, and they're all giving him different pieces of information and ones that he can't really piece together on his own. That's really the beginning of Dot. I would take and scan all his health records and then like Mechanical Turk it in the back end to make it look like this, you know, not very beautiful dashboard.
I appreciate that reference. Not everyone will get that idea of the Mechanical Turk, right? It's when you're doing manual work to make it look automated.
And right.
You became the database, the business layer, all by yourself doing this. Mm-hmm. Did you do it in Excel, or how are you assembling this data?
Just me. I mean, I spun up a Heroku instance initially, and before then we were trying to do it in Excel, but the sharing ability on like even Google Sheets was pretty limiting. And then he wanted to be able to do things like annotate, share, and do like very highly specialized things. And that's when I kind of took it away from there and made it into its own web app.
Mm. In the diabetes space, there's a joke that we make that the day after an engineer becomes diabetic, they create a brand new engineering system built on top of solving diabetes, because the day before you are diagnosed, you don't know the problem exists.
Yep.
Then the problem presents itself, you mourn, and then you say, all right, what are we doing to fix this?
Yep.
So it sounds like that's exactly what you did, except you didn't have the disease.
Right. Yeah, no, it definitely was one of those things where, you know, we kind of sat and thought about it. And because I was a programmer, I was like, this is something that I can do. Like, this is a way I can help.
Contribution.
Absolutely. But I also thought, I think I was very naive getting into health tech, because I'd worked in fintech and like entertainment, like just anything that was not health. I'd always had an interest in it. But I remember getting into it and thinking, okay, I'll make it for him, and it's probably not going to be that great or whatever, and it probably exists already, and he just probably doesn't have access to it. I didn't know anything about how archaic the space was.
And that and by archaic, we mean faxing things. We mean storing random PDFs or images of x-rays on open shares. Like, it was not just archaic. It was almost barbaric because there was no, there's no controls. There's no data provenance. Does Canada have the concept of HIPAA?
Yeah. So it's provincially mandated, though, because healthcare is governed provincially. So in Ontario, which is really the largest, most populous province in Canada, we have something called PHIPAA, which stands for roughly a different variation of HIPAA. But they say some of the same stuff. But going through auditing and making sure that we comply with everything across all the provinces was quite a feat. And I wish we had a federated sort of regulation standard like the US, but you win some, you lose some. Yeah. We have a slightly better healthcare system.
And for folks that are listening who aren't in the US, HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. And it basically just says, we promise that sensitive health information will not be disclosed without your knowledge, that you won't tell somebody that you're sick or any of your test information without knowing, which could happen if you were just storing random things in a share or in an Excel sheet.
Yeah. And I think you're being overly generous, Scott, by saying something would be stored in an open share, because what we've seen is really, I mean, you know, if you're lucky, it's a monolithic database that someone set up in the 80s that still works in some of our largest hospitals. But in other cases, things are stored in paper in a basement, in a health records department, and they are sent by mail courier. So someone photocopies them and sends them by mail courier over. So it's quite backwards.
When I first got sick, I was always the person that went downstairs to the basement, and there's always someone in the basement of the hospital that, you know, is sitting on a computer, and they will burn you a CD of your x-rays. And every time I went down there, this is like 10 or 15 years ago, I always felt like I was breaking a rule. Like, can I have my data?
Right.
Oh, you can't. We're going to have to make phone calls. We're going to have to talk to people. I don't know if that's allowed, but it was my body.
Yep.
What do you think started? When did it start? When did people start realizing that we deserve to have access to our own data?
I think a lot of it, in my opinion, a lot of it has come through with like the focus on the consumer being at the center of everything, obviously with the advent of the smartphone, with everything else around us that does give us access to this data, right? So I think the consumer increasingly became came to be in control of everything. I want to be able to binge watch something instead of having to wait every week. And that's something that we've seen through Netflix in the entertainment industry become a thing. Same thing with like Uber. I want to be able to like not have to like go out there and like hope that a cab shows up. I want to be able to control it and be able to call it. I sometimes joke about how I can see a 10-year history of all my Starbucks orders, right? From the last 10 years, like they store that information, and it is, why is that useful? Why is that information useful? And I recognize that it's just one coffee chain that I'm frequenting for the last 10 years. But I just think it's very interesting how we've become used to seeing a lot of this. And I think in healthcare, it wasn't going to be far behind. If anything, COVID, I think, like really like hyper accelerated that growth in a lot of ways. And of course, with telehealth, that just became like almost instantly, like it was like an overnight thing where everyone was like, yes, we're going to see doctors by video and no one's going to bat an eye. It didn't used to be a thing before. Because even when we started and DOT really came into operation in 2017, late 2017 is when we launched the service. Even then, we had to almost describe the problem and like explain to people why it was important or interesting. And we were very much still focused on the chronic or the comorbid or like something in like the, you know, the sort of frequent flyers of the healthcare system, which is a term maybe I shouldn't use, that's often used in Canada, because it can sometimes have negative connotations. What they mean is these people are frequently using healthcare services in the country. We were really we were restricted to that use case. And after COVID, it's a whole nother world. Suddenly, people are more aware that their information is out there, that they can access it. I think the vaccination receipts and vaccination proofs were a big part of it. But I think, I think it's all about timing, because Google, as I'm sure you know, back in 2010, was it, got into health in a big way, and then like wrapped up that project quickly and has since been in health in a variety of different ways. I think a lot of it comes down to timing.
I went, so I go to the doctor every 3 months, which is unusual. I have a coworker who goes every 7 years, he says, or when something hurts.
Right.
So I am probably a frequent flyer of the healthcare industry. And I recently received an email, literally about a half an hour before I got on the call with you, of my blood work, because I get my blood work checked every 3 months, and it's a pretty comprehensive blood panel. I receive it as a PDF scan. And I can see the handwriting where my doctor basically just circles everything and goes, good.
Right.
Or he says, take more vitamin D. And then a couple of days later, I start getting that parsed. Can you generally give someone a sense of like, I get that there's a piece of paper. I can see his handwriting. That's cool. Then it got scanned. I don't know how that happened. Who did that? Maybe there's a records person. And then did someone OCR it? Did they optical character recognition it? How did it get into a database? And he's just a regular little doctor.
Right.
What's the difference between a doctor who has a small business versus a doctor who's part of a hospital? Could you walk me through the health records life cycle?
Yes. So that's so interesting that you say that, because I've rarely seen those sort of two stages be exposed. You know, it's a little bit showing how the sausage is made to the consumer, I guess. Mm-hmm. But you know, we've seen that a lot. It's often a disconnect between whoever is responsible for sharing this information with all of the patients on the roster of this doctor and the EMR system. So EMR is electronic medical record system. And typically the sort of distinction that I've often been making, and a lot of people in the industry make, but sometimes they're interchangeable, is the difference between an EMR and an EHR. So often hospitals will say electronic health record system, EHR, so like an Epic or a Cerner, but an EMR is usually used by primary care providers. So I know Allscripts has an EMR, for example, but I'm not as familiar with the American landscape. What some of the biggest ones here in Canada are Oscar, Acuro, TELUS, etc. And there's usually these EMR companies, the way they keep their clients for so long and often become some of the most valuable companies in the world and privately held, like Epic, is they keep data hostage. So what you're seeing as a patient is actually just a byproduct of that data being kept hostage by the system, not by the doctor. So clearly, the doctor's trying to share it with you and probably has a policy or something that is, you know, either like telling him stepwise instructions like, hey, lab report back, share it with Scott, something like that. Mm-hmm. But his EMR is not actually making that data easy to export. So the most he can do is maybe print it out, give it to a clerical staff in admin. He or she will scan it and upload it to the portal. And they probably have some kind of a janky, you know, roundabout way.
Yeah. It looks like a bulletin board from like the early 90s. Right. Like 100% old.
I'll bet it's like those old school scanners too. It's not even something that's, you know, digitally transferred. It's probably
it's a fake email interface. So it's like, oh, you got an email. And it looks like you got an email on Yahoo from like the early 90s. And it's an attachment and it's a PDF scan, crooked, of his handwriting. And I saw him yesterday. So some elf, God bless them, scanned it and sent it to me because the doctor said so, it sounds like. Okay, so then what happens a couple days later?
Yeah, so I think likely they have some kind of a batch processing system set up. So they may have something in the back end where all the things that have been sent out to patients for legal reasons or for whatever other, again, internal policy, you know, say we've sent out 50 health records to patients, we need to make sure that these are available to them in XYZ format. Sometimes, and I know after the Biden administration in the US, the data standards became slightly more important than they were previously, where the way in which you're sharing that data is important. So previously, the sort of federal and state legislations were, you have to share the data. Guys, share the data. So it didn't matter how they shared the data. They could mail it to you. They could put it on a CD. They could upload it, whatever it is. But then came sort of Data Standards Act. And I don't think, and I could be wrong, so don't people listening to this should like look it up specifically, but I know it happened in Canada and I know it was very similar in the US at the same time, which was, okay, we need to start mandating the types of formats that you must make this data available in. So maybe it's governed by that, or maybe it's just, again, an internal policy. There's some kind of batch process that runs, you know, every week, every 48 hours, whatever. And it goes in, it OCRs everything. It picks up all the different tests that that were done for you. It maybe tabulates them for you, maybe visualizes some of them for you. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a format that, you know, maybe they have an integration with someone like a Google Fit or an Apple Health, and then it's going to them. So they kind of need to do it that way. It's just so interesting that you would get it two ways. I would just imagine, I would have expected them to just wait and give you the OCR version and it would just be delayed.
Yeah, that is interesting. I just assumed that that was kind of the way it was always done. And I didn't realize that if he didn't send it to me, I would just wait a week and then they would send me the HTML table and then it would appear in Apple Health somewhere.
Right.
This episode is brought to you by Interval.com. Interval is the front-endless framework for internal app development. Interval lets you say goodbye to writing REST API routes, using drag-and-drop UI builders, or writing React code just to build internal dashboards. Instead, with just a few lines of code in your existing Node.js backend codebase, Interval transforms your backend functions into tools that anyone on your team, especially non-technical people on your customer support and operations team, can use. Start building for free at Interval.com today by going to interval.com/Hanselminutes. That's interval.com/Hanselminutes. So then there's this thing, speaking of standards, called FHIR,
yes,
Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources.
Yeah.
Now, I was involved in the financial industry as well. You were in fintech.
Yeah.
And I was on the board of the OFX, you know, Open Financial Exchange, XML kind of thing. So if you ever use like Quicken or QuickBooks or Microsoft Money, we created this standard that lets you download your checkbook.
Right.
But something like FHIR is way more complicated. It's not just your balances, it's your entire medical history.
Yeah.
This has been around for a while now. Is it taking off?
I think it's hit a number of hurdles. And I think just in terms of championing it, I think one thing, so Apple Health had some FHIR templating standards built in. And I think that was a big thing for the FHIR community, because I think they'd kind of been fighting this uphill battle for a really long time. And it's an open source sort of volunteer-led effort really worldwide. And DOT employs a lot of FHIR standards in stuff that we put out. And one thing that we've noticed is also there's, you know, without exaggeration, about a million different types of health records out there. And I think that's what makes it really, really difficult. So I'm with you on the financial side of things. Sure, there are, of course, competing formats or competing standards or, you know, different ways of storing the same type of data. But it's nowhere near as complicated as how health data is stored, because it's not even, oh, this is a different test or a new test. It is, this is, you know, the 117th permutation of how these four tests are related to this one imaging. And that complexity, I think, has made the FHIR adoption so much more challenging than it would be if it were any other industry. So I'm a big supporter of it. I think it's, I think Apple's definitely helped it along quite a bit. I'm hopeful that once it becomes more of like, you know, a lot of what we're talking about is very country specific or like very like state specific in some cases, province specific in our case. But there will come a time when all of this has to be globally mandated, governed, regulated. And I think at that point, these formats and all the work that the FHIR community has put in will really, I think, have a chance to flourish in its own way. Or there will be a superseding standard, of course, that this evolves to.
Yeah. So I'm managing my diabetes situation. My wife is a cancer survivor. We're here in Oregon in the US, but her mom is in Zimbabwe and we manage her health remotely with a Google Sheet, and her mom literally carries around, because her mom, there's seven kids. So she goes from kid to kid. So grandma lives with a couple kids for 6 months and a couple kids. So she has a manila folder.
Right.
That is her entire health history. So I'm, in my mind, I'm trying to like reconcile that it's 2022.
Yeah.
And I could have something like a DOT Health app with a health timeline of everything.
Right.
But at the same time, someone else in another country has a manila folder that they keep in their purse and they carry around with them. And this is my health timeline.
Yeah.
There's something good about holding it in your hand, though. So if I'm looking at something in .health, where is the data stored and what is your data portability feelings?
Yeah. So we've tried to be really the solution to a lot of the ills that we saw in the industry, right? So .never stores the data hostage. We don't mine the data or do anything like sneaky or evil with it. We don't maintain shadow profiles of you if you delete your account, things like that. It is stored on .dot servers. So we are acting, and in Canada, just the way the legislation works, the role that we occupy in the Canadian legal system is a proxy for the patient. So that's really the role we're playing. We are being instructed by the patient through explicit consent on our system to store the data on their behalf. And then if they ask us, we will get rid of it altogether. If they need us to. So we're not really there's a role called health information custodian, the HIC, which is really the healthcare provider's role. And we're not really, that's not the role that we occupy, but because an individual, it would add complexity if we asked every individual to store their own data in their own like Dropbox or database or whatever. So to make it easier, we've set it up this way, but we try to be like not evil at all with it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So it's like a Google Photos or a OneDrive where you are the steward. It's like when I buy a storage unit, I am giving them on my behalf, I want you to store my stuff. You own the building, but I own the stuff.
That's right.
Okay. And I can come get the stuff whenever I want to. Like I recently went to Twitter and I said, give me an archive of all my tweets. I can do the exact same thing.
Yeah. Just specialized to health records. And of course, a huge part of what we apply on top is a layer of visualization. There's like, you know, different things, like it explains certain things to you that would otherwise feel really like medically and you know, kind of nonsense to a non-doctor. That's a big part of .dot.
Well, that's one of the cool things about the app is this health timeline. And I know that you are an engineer, but you also have a background in design. So you don't meet a lot of designer engineers. You know what I mean? Like you're not usually allowed to be good at two things. I don't know how you manage that.
I was just going to say, I have so many friends who are designers and engineers.
Oh my goodness. They're all in Canada then.
Yeah. I went to school for industrial engineering. And I think that sort of area specifically is, you know, we sometimes like to call it modern day engineering. It's basically the improvement on existing engineering standards in a lot of ways, systems, et cetera. And so there are a ton of engineers who've made, you know, the switch over from engineering to either design or tech broadly. So I went to the University of Toronto and about, without exaggeration, 75% of my class left immediately after because there's such a demand for this type of background, but applied to so many different industries, including design.
Yeah. When comparing the UI of .health with the other health records apps, and there's about four or five I have to deal with, my health record and my chart, and just a bunch of different things, but as well as Apple Health.
Yeah.
You're the only one that has a timeline, and it reminds me a lot of the Google Maps timeline because it's such a logical way of doing things. Here's the thing that happened most recently, and I can just scroll back and see what happened before while everyone else doesn't treat it like that.
Right.
Do you think that that's something unique to your solution?
I think when it comes to us, I mean, I do think we've built a really beautiful consumer interface that's really built in part by user feedback. So again, when we started, I personally didn't know anything, and like the early team also didn't know a ton about the healthcare space. So we were really operating off of usability standards of like, you know, what is going to be more useful in this context. And that's really where the timeline is coming from. So I'd love to say, you know, yeah, we kind of, this is our brainchild and like, this is why it looks like this, but it's actually because this is the most useful way to capture a person's entire health history. And often a lot of the portals out there will be very specific to an institution, or they will be specific to a condition. And .dot doesn't care about any of that. And because it doesn't care about any of that, we have to put things on a timeline because otherwise they would make no sense. So that's really why it's like this. I do think the big thing that we're trying to do is not become a fancier or more beautiful or, you know, a health record portal with a timeline. We really want to be the plumbing of the healthcare system. We want to be that data transferring ability that's behind the scenes. I like to compare it to like the Visa Visa rails, which is how you can tap your card at a coffee shop and the financial transaction will happen in a few milliseconds. That's really the role that Dot is occupying with some of the customers that we're working with now. And it's a bit of a pivot that we've made in the business as well. This was late 2019 when we did it. So we did pivot quite a bit to servicing the healthcare provider and then doing almost a B2B2C sort of transition from being a pure consumer product initially.
That's very interesting because you have this single pane of glass concept, right. But I have to go in, find my providers, OAuth to my providers. Right. So the other providers still exist. And when I go see a new doctor, I'll inevitably get an email saying, sign up for our portal that sucks.
Right.
And then I have to go into something like Dot or another system right. And then tell them about that portal. Are you saying that you can hide a lot of that in the back end and I don't have to worry about it so much?
That's exactly it. So unlike, say, an Apple Health, which does OAuth into a separate portal, we actually don't do any of that. So Dot has a network now across Canada of just over 60,000 providers where we pull this data for you. So you're not having to remember multiple passwords. We're not scraping any screens to get your data. You're telling us and giving us permission. You're telling us which doctors you've been to and giving us permission to go fetch your information. And we have some kind of a digital pre-existing relationship with these providers, and we have quite a large network now, and we're getting this data for you, and really the only login you're worrying about is the Dot one. So we're a little bit different in how we've approached it, and a big reason behind it, again, is the usability piece. You know, the moment you start, and going back to some of the fintech roots, one of the first projects I did, my first job out of school was an accounting SaaS business called Wave, and I worked with a product called Yodlee, which screen scrapes all your bank account information. Yodlee. And it would break all the time.
They were the worst.
It would break all the time. And my first project at Wave was to move us from Yodlee to Cash Edge.
Yeah.
And you know, Cash Edge was just another Yodlee. Like, it was equally bad. It scraped a bunch of information. And we definitely didn't want to replicate that problem at Dot. And I think our way is a lot better. It's, you know, you get real-time access to this data. We get to bolt on and create visuals that are at least the same across a bunch of different providers. And you don't have to worry about multiple logins.
I haven't pulled that brain cell out in at least 20 years. Yodlee. Imagine if you had a giant global problem and you decided to use regular expressions to solve it.
Yep.
That was Yodlee.
That's a great way of putting it. I agree completely.
Yeah, it was the worst. Yeah, because they were basically trying to build web services on systems that didn't have web services, so they would just scrape it with headless browsers.
Right.
And that's not an answer. So let me ask you this. You take over Canada, but I know you have a global perspective.
Yeah.
How do you then go into larger North America or go into the world? How does .health.ca be .everything?
Yeah, I do think this is a global problem, and partially because of our, you know, we've gone and spoken at FHIR conventions in Europe because we were one of the, so Dot's not, you know, I think Dot is a significant size from a patient portal perspective. We have close to 2 million people on the platform without very much of anything. Like, we haven't really marketed our direct-to-consumer product at all. And I think sort of the next largest one in Canada, maybe 100,000 people on it. So we recognize that there's some use on the patient end. We also realize this is a global issue. And the way we initially thought about it is quite a bit different post-COVID than it was 2017. So initially we thought, okay, we're going to grow across Canada. We know how to do it. We're gaining traction. We have a big network. We're going to replicate it in systems that are most similar to ours around the world. So immediately UK, Australia come to mind because they're both public healthcare systems governed by some kind of public governance model. But during COVID, we actually started working with a number of US-based healthcare providers who were looking for very basic things. Like, we want to show proof of vaccination. We want to be able to show people this specific piece of health information. And so as we started working with them and started to get almost opportunities coming to us, which never happens in health tech, you always have to beat down the door and spend 2 years on sales cycles to get one contract. we started to notice the opportunity in the States. Not that we didn't know it existed, but being a private healthcare system, it's quite a bit different. So our immediate roadmap does have a US expansion strategy in there. But when we think about how we're going to do this from a global perspective, we're really looking to partner with health networks, healthcare providers that have the same problem that we've solved for so many people. You have, you know, a bunch of different healthcare providers servicing the same patient population. How do you pull those resources together? That's really where DOT shines. And the only way we grow is through those types of partnerships. It's very much like a Visa and Bank of America, you know, kind of partnership model, which has to apply in all the different jurisdictions.
One of the other things I wanted to cover just as we get towards the end of the show is that you've been on the board of directors for Tech Girls Canada for a very long time. It's a hub for Canadian women in science, technology, engineering, and math. How do women, young women react when they find out that you're a designer, engineer, CEO, founder of a large and successful company like this that has such a huge effect on such a large number of people?
From the reactions I've seen, I always kind of will enter rooms, and we were talking about this a little bit earlier. My identity as like the token diverse person, right? So for people who can't see me, I'm a person of color. I operate in a predominantly, you know, homogenous, like largely male dominated healthcare industry, actually. I'm visibly religious. I'm an immigrant to Canada. Like there's so many layers to this. And I think initially when I entered the industry, I wanted to shed all of that away and just be like, listen, we know, you know, we're a private healthcare company. We know what we're doing. We know we can solve a problem, and we know we can be successful in this, this, and this way. And this is why you should back us, partner with us, invest in us, whatever it is. And I really wanted to go that route. And I think during my journey, I've definitely noticed this sort of shift in walking into rooms or doing like plenaries and stuff like that, or like welcoming people into lectures where people are like, we didn't think you existed. Like you being here is like wild to us. So there's so many, like especially women of color, who will come up to me and be like, we didn't think the thing that you're doing was possible, actually. So that's been, I think, a learning thing for me, a huge sort of learning opportunity for me. And it's been quite humbling because I didn't think much about it initially, for better or worse.
That is cool. It is something where it's like, sometimes it matters and sometimes it doesn't matter and it shouldn't matter. And right. You have to decide when you want to present that. I've talked about my type 1 diabetes, which like a tall, straight, white guy from the West Coast of the US.
Yeah.
That's not particularly interesting. And if I didn't tell you that I had all these medical implants and all these challenges, you'd never know. You know, you could have a wooden leg.
Right.
You can either, but then when I started to present it in public, I would have people come up afterwards and said, I didn't know that my son who's 7, who has diabetes, could have a job like yours.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, wow, I never even thought about it. Like it doesn't have anything to do with my job, but it was cool that you appreciated the representation.
Mm-hmm. I think it is important. I'm not trying to downplay the importance of either representation or women being in engineering roles, even board roles. So one of the first hospitals we built an integration to was the Sinai Health System, which is one of the largest health networks in Canada. I now sit on the board at Sinai. And I sometimes think about that sort of trajectory, where like one day we were like, nobody at Sinai would talk to us, to now being like intimately familiar with the leadership team there. And I think even women being on boards is so important, and being in areas where they can have that type of impact, because right now all those spaces are occupied by very similar viewpoints. And I think there's a ton of work to be done there.
That's very cool. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me. I love this.
This is great fun. We've been learning all about DOT Health with Huda Idris, founder and CEO of DOT Health at dothealth.ca. You can check him out online and check out Huda on Twitter. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.